Hi, I'm Tim Schenk. I'd like to thank you all for listening to Booked, our Descent feature where we talk with the authors of important, significant, otherwise exciting and awesome new books. Very happy to be talking today with Kimberly Phillips Fine. Kim's a historian at NYU, author of her fantastic first book on the making of the modern right called Invisible Hands, and now a new book, Fear City, New York's Fiscal Crisis and the Rise of Austerity Politics. Kim, thanks for coming.
Thanks so much for having me.
Right. So, Fear City, who gave New York that title, other than you in this book?
Right. Well, the title of the book refers, the title of the book is drawn from a pamphlet, which is actually reproduced as the frontispiece of the book, but it's not the cover, which is important. I'll say more about it in a minute. The pamphlet was produced by a coalition of police unions in the summer, early in the summer of 1975. And it says, "Welcome to Fear City," and features a picture of a kind of grinning skull. And the pamphlet was produced with the intent of being distributed by police officers at the city's airports, especially JFK. And the police unions produced this after Mayor Beam announced the layoff of several thousand police officers. And on the inside of the pamphlet, it goes on to talk about the how dangerous New York is. It's kind of purporting to be a warning to tourists who might be coming here. How dangerous the city is, how you shouldn't go outside after 6 p.m., how you should stay off the subways at all costs, how you most certainly should go nowhere near the South Bronx, called Fort Apache, kind of repeating that. So it is, the pamphlet is painting this picture of New York as this horrifying and violent metropolis.
And this is from the city's cops
who
are doing
this. It's from the city's cops who are doing this. And the mayor, Mayor Beam, we'll talk more about later.
He'll come up later, don't worry.
He was furious about this pamphlet and actually went to court to try to get an injunction to stop them from handing it out. He was successful in doing that. It was quickly overturned. But they kind of let go of the idea and never handed it out en masse. Although they did drive around the city with these sound trucks kind of blaring these messages like, you know, when was the last time you or someone you know was mugged? So the pamphlet was this kind of, you know, police, you know, it was this very intransigent thing for the police officers to do vis-a-vis the mayor. And it also was trafficking in many different, you know, basically racist stereotypes about the city. And so I think it's actually important, though, my title was drawn from that, Welcome to Fear City. The book is just called Fear City. But the cover of the book is this wonderful image. I didn't design this, but I was very delighted by the artist who did. It's kind of the city viewed from on high and of the skyscrapers kind of shrouded in mist. And I think part of the point of that title or is in this context is that the book is really about fear. And, you know, not really so much fear of crime or fear of violence. Many of the kind of stereotypes about the city during the 70s, the image of New York that comes from movies like Taxi Driver, and the kind of rich cultural, the many portrayals of the dystopian metropolis at that moment. The book is really about fear, but fear coming from the upper levels of the city, coming from its skyscrapers, from its elites, and how that fear was mobilized to transform New York.
Which is a real connection with your earlier work, too. It's like how elites mobilize and can change politics by exerting the power that they have at their disposal, but sometimes don't know how to use.
Yeah.
As you really see in this book, sort of like New York's elite coming into sort of awareness of the power that it can have in the right circumstances.
Yeah, the book has a lot of points of connection and also some points of difference with Invisible Hands, but certainly the question, which I think I've always really been fascinated by, how do people with economic power try to translate that into political power at different moments? What are the, you know, rather than just assuming that they can do so and know how to do so in a very transparent, straightforward way, kind of taking it as a problem and a question, how does that happen? How do they come to do that? How do they, you know, how do you kind of move from a position of economic wealth to actually being able to change the broader society.
And so, welcome.
And yeah, this is a book about one moment when some people did that.
Yeah, and so, in like Welcome to Fear City, this pamphlet, it works so well as part of your title because it captures the sense of the city in crisis that provides like the book with the fulcrum. But there's the before time too, and it's in order to understand how they arrived at this sense of crisis, you have to understand what it felt like before.
Yeah.
And there's this fantastic phrase to describe New York during this period as sort of before this period, in sort of the middle of the 20th century, as an island of social democracy.
Yeah.
You quote this in the book. So can you explain what happened before? What was the sense? There's a sense that the 1970s were a moment where New York shifted decisively from one model to another. So what was the first model?
Well, so this book, I think, is really bringing up ideas that were developed by, kind of most centrally by historian Josh Freeman in his wonderful book, Working Class New York, and actually also by Mason Williams, a younger historian in his book, City of Ambition, about New York in the 1930s and the relationship between Roosevelt and LaGuardia.
And an example, and we can get to this later, an example of a very successful relationship of cooperation between the local government and the federal government, as opposed to what we'll see in the 70s.
Right. Yeah, so these two books both, in different ways, outline the kind of story of the creation of a New York as a very distinctive city in the middle years of the 20th century. So New York, in the kind of post-war, post-1945 moment, is a city with it's very different in some important ways from the city that we know today. It was, for one thing, its employment base was predominantly blue-collar and industrial in particular. Different kind of industrial base than in a city like Detroit. You don't have just like a one large manufacturer, but many different small manufacturers kind of running throughout the city. In a diversity of different areas, but especially garment manufacturing, printing, electrical, kind of light electrical manufacturing, and the like. And it is a city with an unusually large and generous public sector, which grows, partly out of its distinctive relationship with the federal government and the large amount of federal money that came into the city during the 1930s, and also out of the city's long kind of labor tradition and left-wing political tradition, which was able to exert pressure on the city government to create this remarkable set of resources. So the city had a very extensive public health program. It had a network of more than 20 at the peak municipal hospitals, as well as public clinics, primary care clinics located throughout the five boroughs. It had a very ambitious public health department, which conducted its own independent research into matters of public health. It had it had famously free higher education, tuition.
Yeah, free tuition at CUNY seems to me almost like the most like powerful symbol of this period.
It was a very powerful symbol, and it's also important, CUNY had been free since its inception, but it was also growing during the 50s and 60s. So the campuses were expanding. It was moving from the kind of the flagship schools, City College, and then Brooklyn College and Hunter, but many of the other community colleges and new 4-year campuses were opening. So it was actually this kind of expansive promise at this point. It becomes a graduate school at this moment. It has this free higher education. The subway system is another, more than 720 miles of subways running throughout the city. There's a very strong political commitment to keeping that low cost. And then during the 1960s, there's a kind of further expansion of the local welfare state during the Great Society, War on Poverty years, as new federal money flows into New York. The city expands kind of daycares for low-income families. It begins to operate different drug treatment programs and facilities.
And this expansion, it continues under John Lindsay, Republican mayor?
Yes, it continues.
So, Republican will be brought into the sort of social democratic moment.
Yes. I mean, Lindsay was
a peculiar
Republican, and also, late in his mayoralty, he shifts to become a Democrat.
Not unlike Mike Bloomberg, but the differences in what he chose to focus on and what Bloomberg focused on say a lot about their respective periods.
He was really, he was a kind of progressive Republican, and, so very, very different from the kind of Republican Party today, and actually even in some ways from the Republican Party of his time too. So he kind of continues this expansion of spending and the development of this very extensive public sector. There's also, and I think this is especially, Mason's book really talks about this, but the sort of physical representations of this, the public works programs, the building of airports, parks, playgrounds, swimming pools.
Like these magnificent libraries.
The libraries, yes. This kind of this you know, visual representation, or this physical representation of a set of values and a kind of vision of the city, I think.
Which is, I feel like, also underpinned by this notion of abundance, and that, like, in the most wealthy society in the history of the world, there's no reason why we shouldn't be able to demand these certain, like, goods, not just as neat tricks that we can have, maybe, but as, like, rights that are just a prerequisite for modern civilization.
Yeah, I think this does, this vision sort of runs through the city, and it's, you know, I think this is actually, I think it's, you know, this is a, it is a kind of imperfect, it is incomplete. It is, you know, I would never say that New York in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s was some kind of, you know, utopia. There is much good scholarship. I would point, for example, to Craig Wilder's book, A Covenant with Color, which is about the, you know, the kind of differences in the ways that African-American neighborhoods experience the public works spending of the LaGuardia years and afterwards. You know, it's a very imperfect city nonetheless. It is not as though divisions of race or class are transcended in post-war New York. But I think there is this policy that at least provides some counter, however partial and incomplete it may be.
So it seems like a pretty nice vision, at least from today.
Right.
When and why did the wheels start coming off the bus?
Right. Well, the city runs into many problems in the 1960s and early 1970s. In part, this is because of the kinds of economic shifts that are affecting cities across the Northeast and Midwest, deindustrialization and the kind of flight of white middle class people to the suburbs and the subsequent erosion of the tax base. New York also there's kind of conflicting visions within the city as well about the way to address this kind of what to do as the industrial base begins to depart. And in some cases, that is actually kind of actively furthered by parts of the city's elite that promote rezoning neighborhoods to be more oriented towards residential and office construction. And not kind of trying in any real way to protect the industrial base. So the city's economy is shifting. The city is becoming poorer. It's becoming less white. And it is, you know, it has a set of, you know, it runs into difficulty generating the revenue that it needs to cover the programs that it has been operating. And I think another dimension of this kind of shifts in the war on poverty. And the kind of both the new demands and new money that the war on poverty programs create, there is also, you know, there's a kind of, you know, as the war on poverty draws to a close, or the Johnson administration ends and Nixon comes in, and it's not as though that spending kind of drops precipitously right away, but it ceases growing as it had been. As rapidly as it had been, and that I think also kind of is a problem the city runs into. So there's a set of questions that emerge about how will a city continue to finance and pay for this generous public sector. And there's also, I guess, a politics to this, which emerges as the 60s goes on, and an increasing set of questions about who is the city government really responsive to, and a deepening set of fears, again, among parts of the city's elite, about whether their voice is appropriately heard or kind of responded to. And this comes up especially in the mid-1960s, early in the Lindsay years. He goes to Albany, and you know, New York is always dependent on Albany to create new taxes in the first place. And he wants to create a stock transfer tax, so kind of just taking a little bit of money off of each time a stock trades hands. People of the New York Stock Exchange are enraged by this and threaten to move the whole stock exchange to Stamford, Connecticut, or Woodbridge.
And again, a Republican mayor who's proposing this new tax on Wall Street.
Yeah, so this kind of this, and it actually wins, it passes. the people at the stock exchange are really very troubled by this and say, you know, there's no way out of this. The city's just going to be under more and more pressure for more taxes. We have to look at alternatives and continue just moving, you know, the New York Stock Exchange out of New York. So they, as they're saying, they're doing this, there's also, you know, the growth of that, the welfare state in the late 60s is the result of popular pressure from below. So in there are sit-ins at welfare offices in the city. There are takeovers at the Lincoln Hospital in the South Bronx, organized by the Young Lords. There is there are protests at City College and throughout the CUNY system to open the school and make it more representative of the racial diversity of the city, leading to the adoption of an open admissions policy in 1969, so that now anybody in the city is able to go to college if you've graduated from high school, again, for free. And so there's a kind of mobilization from below that's driving this expansion of the public sector, and it is met with, you know, increasing anxiety from people in the city's elite. That's sort of what is happening. But there's both a kind of change in the political economy and also, I think, a deepening change in the city's politics. And we can talk more about how Mayor Lindsay and then Beam kind of respond to this, which is, I think, one of the important parts of the story.
So exactly. You have this, like, thwacks to the city's tax base. Mm-hmm. You have, like, diminishing or at least sort of less aggressive support from the federal government than officials had expected. And these stubborn demands for mm-hmm. continuing public policies that people are claiming as, like, mm-hmm. a right that belongs to them mm-hmm. now. And in a word, it seems like the solution to this problem that New York City officials decided upon was debt.
Yes.
So what did debt do?
So one of the
this?
Central issues here is, I think, that the first Lindsay and then Mayor Beam, who succeeded him, what they decided to do, and in some ways it's not even, you know, even after working on this, I think how... What exactly were they thinking was going to happen?
There are some, like, shocking stories in here of people just not really knowing what they were doing. The accounting for the city was a mess. It seemed
like there was a very high level of chaos in the city's basic bookkeeping operation. And I have struggled a lot to think about how to approach this question exactly. What are the politics of, like, what does it mean that the city's budget operations were in such complete disarray and uncertainty, such that it was, I think, on some level, people really did not actually know fully how much debt the city was taking
on. Do you think it's because they didn't want to know? And there's a sense that if they looked too hard, they might find something they didn't want to see?
Yeah, I think there is a sense in which, I think there was a way in which the city's borrowings, what the city does is it starts to take on more and more short-term debt. And it does so using these vehicles that are basically... they're these short-term notes that don't have to be backed by, they're not voted on the way that general obligation bond issues are, and they are backed by the promise of future revenues that were supposed to come in. So it's structured into them that you don't actually have the revenues right then, you will have them later. And I think that, and these notes kind of had high interest rates and they kind of climbed higher still, so borrowing heavily using them wound up meaning the city was even further in debt because it now had all this debt service it had to pay back. And I think there's a way in which there's a kind of evasion at the heart, you know, it was sort of a gamble on the future. They think that city officials were hoping that the political situation would change. They were hoping that somehow they would kind of come into more money in the future from the federal government or somewhere else. And they did not really want to address or take seriously the political conflicts that were emerging about what the scope and size of the city government
was. It reminded me a lot of the way that liberals started talking about economic growth in the late 1940s and early 1950s. That's another way of avoiding these political or social conflicts, except that where growth is a great vocabulary for an age of abundance, debt seems to make a lot more sense for postponing conflicts in an age of, like, limits and restriction.
Yeah, I think that's a great comparison.
But, and then, so all of these burdens, they fall on the shoulders, as we mentioned already, of Mayor Abraham Beam. Right. What was his background coming into this crisis?
Yeah, so Beam had grown up in poverty, really, on the Lower East Side. He actually emigrated. He was brought to the country as an infant. His parents were essentially fleeing Tsarist Russia. His father was a socialist, and his mother died when he was pretty young, and Beam kind of grew up on the Lower East Side. He had some neighbors down the block who were killed in the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire. His father took him to hear Eugene Debs speak at the Jewish Daily Forward building. He grew up around the settlement halls of the neighborhood. And he really, he emerged out of this, the world of the city's welfare state. He himself went to City College, where he studied accounting. And then he got active in the city's democratic machine, and he kind of built his career through these machine relationships.
And was a fantastic student as well. Like, not just, like, yes. any old accountant who has to take care of the city's debt problem, but someone who got, like, a perfect score, right?
He was widely respected. He had served as the comptroller under Lindsay. He was, when he ran for mayor, the New York Times kind of praised him and said, finally we'll have somebody who really understands the city's finances. So he was a very, he was someone who had really worked his way up through the kind of existing kind of public sector of the city.
And despite this radical childhood, it's not like he came in with a radical ideological agenda or even like much of an ideological agenda at all. It just seemed like he was there to make the city's government work effectively.
Irving Howe actually has a beautiful description of him and in the book World of Our Fathers. He writes a little bit about Beam there, and the sort of world of Jewish socialism, I mean, Beam was not a radical by any stretch of the imagination. It didn't really stay with him as a kind of lived or vibrant, as a vibrant politics. He was no political thinker or theorist. He was really barely, he was not an inspiring speaker. He was not somebody who kind of could put forth a full-throated defense and vision, kind of the city's vision. I think that it had kind of worked his way into his basic assumptions about the world. And it was kind of inconceivable to him to think of it giving way. He took things like the later attacks on CUNY as sort of a personal insult. He felt that he himself wouldn't, be where he was were it not for the free tuition. So in the book, I think I view him as a somewhat tragic figure. He was kind of caught between two different visions of the world, and he didn't really know how to, he found himself in this dilemma. He didn't know how to get out, and he was not somebody, I think, he was not kind of the leader of a political movement. He was not going to, mount a really full challenge to the remaking of the city. But he was also, at the same time, he instinctively clung to it. He didn't want to let it go.
I think he also had this sense that, to use a phrase that would come up much later in American history, that New York City was too big to fail.
Yes.
And that the bailout would come along eventually.
Right.
So why didn't the state government come in once the bills are coming due, these pressures are mounting? And New York City, it seems like it's entering a crisis. That's not good for New York State. It's not good for the image of the United States abroad. Why wouldn't the state government or the federal government come in and provide some assistance?
I think that's really true, that he was not alone in this. He and many others felt or just had the sense that, the city really couldn't be allowed to go bankrupt. And at some point, somehow, somewhere, it wasn't clear how, but the money was going to arrive.
So why couldn't it?
Right. So why did it not come to New York? Another theme that I talk about in the book, and one of the things I think the book actually kind of contributes to the existing work about the fiscal crisis, is the central role of the comptroller's office. Mm-hmm. There was a kind of generational divide in the city's, in the Beam administration, between Beam and his kind of closest friends and allies, who were also people who had come up through the democratic machine, not people who had gone to Ivy League schools.
The comptroller's office, by the way, seems like a great place, a fun place to have been in the early 1970s. You have one of your key characters is this Harvard Business School alum who sort of drops out of society, winds up at the comptroller's office, shows up to work every day in a dashiki and jeans.
Yes. So there are these people, this kind of younger generation of people who have kind of wound up working for the city.
Yeah.
But who have these kind of countercultural ties. This is, this is right after Nixon's left office. It is right at, you know, the United States has just lost the Vietnam War. It is a time of kind of disillusion with elites and with the existing social order to begin with. And I think that this influences, I mean, so in the comptroller's office, and to some extent with the participation of the comptroller himself, who was a much younger man, Harrison J. Golden, who, you know, had come out, he had been in the Justice Department in the early 60s and had been in Mississippi. He, you know, they start to express these doubts and fears about the city's finances and especially about its bookkeeping practices. And they have little interest, they don't have any kind of underlying allegiance to the order of things in the city. They are uncertain about what's going to happen and about, you know, I think they become also anxious about what exactly the comptroller is sort of signing off on. And they start, you know, their memos and conversations are part of what trigger a growing fear among the city's banks and a growing unwillingness in the city's financial
community.
And
what time period are we talking about?
Yeah, so this is like 1974, really, kind of over the course of 1974 and early in 1975.
And so 74, 75 is really going to be sort of the key point of the crisis.
Yeah.
So things have been building for a long time, and
I think this is actually very important, that, you know, the city's banks, you know, you can see that problems are emerging. It's not like it's a complete secret. The New York Times actually reports periodically on how the city is increasingly raiding its capital budget or its long-term spending to pay for annual operating costs. This is not really good news, but it's a, you know, people kind of know about this. But nonetheless, the banks are happy to keep selling the debt to the national market. They're happy to keep holding it themselves. The rating agencies are happy to kind of give New York's bonds strong ratings. I think there is, again, this sense New York is the largest, most powerful city. How could it actually go approach bankruptcy? And so that's all been true. And then over the course of 1974, Beam's first year in office, that starts to fall apart. I think another important part of the story is the changing interests of the banks, that the banks, this is the era, the kind of the beginning of financial deregulation. It is a time when the city was the kind of the major banks, so the biggest banks in the city are First National, Citibank, which is, you know, the predecessor to Citibank, Chase Manhattan Bank, Bankers Trust. There are others too, but those are kind of the largest, and they're expanding their overseas operations and investments. This has an effect on their tax structure, what the taxes that they're paying, some of the tax advantages they had previously had for holding municipal bonds are not as strong. They're also, in a way, less geographically focused.
Yeah, you have a sense of them. They now feel like they're part of this global marketplace rather than pure New Yorkers.
Right. They're not. I mean, I think they're, and some of the bankers talked about this later on in depositions and the like. They talked about how there had been a feeling of pride in financing this big, important city. And in some ways, that is kind of giving way in the early to mid 70s. And it's not seeming, you know, instead of being proud of it, it's now this kind of dangerous investment that you have no real reason to want to hold anymore. So as 1974 turns to 1975, the banks are becoming increasingly doubtful and increasingly worried. They actually kind of go and meet with congressional leaders themselves, leaders from people from the banks. They meet with Beam. And by the spring of 1975, they have said, and after several, you know, kind of deals that almost fall apart and then don't quite, there's actually a state agency that defaults on, almost falls on some of its debt, and a lawsuit that's emerging saying that the city is over its debt limit. And so there are all these like little things that set off alarm bells. And in the spring of 1975, the banks come and they say, you know, we're not going to do it any longer. We're not going to underwrite the city's debt offerings. The markets have, you know, there will be no more financing of the city's debts. And that is kind of what really takes this kind of difficult fiscal situation and turns it into the fiscal crisis, because after that point, it's not clear how the city will keep operating.
Do you think the bankers were justified in doing this, or that this is in some sense a manufactured crisis?
You know, were they justified in doing it? I mean, well, this is kind of points to a larger issue, but yes, I think in a way they are justified in doing it, in that the city, if you kind of take the narrow view, the city's, you know, what is the job and responsibility of a bank is the, I think they were legitimately worried about the safety of their investments and about what they were, you know, about whether it made sense from a financial perspective for them to underwrite this debt. I think they were also worried about the legal implications, and that they would be at some point sued for fraud if the city went bankrupt and they had been selling this debt and not fully disclosing the anxieties that they had about it. And so I don't think that the, you know, I think that the, you know, on one level, I think it made sense for them. I don't think that, and this is actually maybe where I don't see them as saying, you know, we're going to engineer this crisis in order to transform the city. I don't exactly think that that's how ideology works or how elites exercise power necessarily. And so but at the same time, you know, were there other options for them? Yes, I also believe there were other, you know, they made a choice. There were other things that they could have potentially done or tried to do. And, you know, they took this road, which had a certain set of results.
I was struck so much in the book by how much, and this is something I hadn't anticipated when I was going into reading it, how much this seemed to me to reflect the period in a way that would be sort of the period of the 1970s and this, like, particular shit turning point in American politics, in the same way that some future historian will turn around sort of this really fantastic account of the financial crisis
right.
in 2008. And in particular, like, Beam, who's, like, at this point, it seems like he's desperately appealing to everyone. He's outraged that people don't believe him, that New York City's going to survive it. He reminded me so much of a Dick Fuld, the CEO of Lehman Brothers, in these accounts, where it's like, no, it's like, of course we're going to work. No, it's like, and it's always, like, everybody's fault but his, and these sort of, like, frantic efforts to solve a problem that, like, basically seems insoluble. And so, like, mm-hmm. just as, like, this later thing captured one moment, this seems to capture another, which means, so, like, with the bankers, when that barrier starts to erect itself, that's when he starts looking for help from other branches of the government.
Right.
And that's when you get to the line that opens this book, where Ford's response to Beam's request, summarized famously by the New York Daily News as, what, Ford to City, drop dead.
Yes. So one of the things, I think, you know, I started writing this book in 2008, really, the fall of 2008, where I started researching it. And I don't think I was really thinking about it consciously, I do think that that kind of sense of a crisis and the dynamics, the political dynamics of a financial or fiscal crisis.
Like the way you were describing, like, these articles in the Times saying, like, oh, right. New York City is buying up all this debt, but things will turn out okay. I'm sure
right.
they're perfect
sure
analogs to, like, homeowners.
Yes,
saying, like,
exactly.
You find the same articles later. It's like, homeowners, they sort of love this stuff. All
right,
that's a problem that'll solve itself someday.
Right. Yeah, I think the sense of, I guess both the sense of the way that in a crisis like this, things happen very quickly, and that the you know, your sense of what the reality is constantly shifting. And also, but also, I think the way that the dynamics of the crisis are such that they shut out any larger questions about where this came from, why it happened. So that, you know, in the financial crisis, there's the larger questions of kind of why is there so much subprime debt? What are the dynamics of inequality that are driving this? What is the role of financial deregulation? I mean, these kinds of questions get sort of shut out by the logic of the kind of the mentality of the crisis.
And then it intersects with the Ford administration, which you
right.
depict as tied up with this
yeah.
surging conservative movement.
Mm-hmm. So what happens, and what really kind of turns the crisis, what makes it possible for the crisis to wind up having this larger effect on the city's politics is the Ford administration. So Beam, along with the governor of New York State, Hugh Carey, go to Washington, D.C., and they ask the Ford administration for help, any kind of help. And the Ford administration is really quite I would say, gleefully intransigent in denying New York assistance.
And you have this line from Don Rumsfeld where he describes his position as, like, not just no, but hell no.
Right, right, right. Yes, yeah. There's, and I think he says, you know, it would be outrageous. This is a different memo, but he says, you know, it would be outrageous to go along with New York, both for the precedent it would set and because it would delay them cleaning up their mess.
And Rumsfeld, who's chief of staff for Ford at the time.
Who's chief of staff for Ford at the time. And Ford is also advised by Alan Greenspan, who is in his kind of first public role as the chair of Ford's Council of Economic Advisors. He's recently out of the Ayn Rand inner circle. Also, William Simon, Ford's Treasury Secretary, who will go on to head the Olin Foundation and be the first head of the Olin Foundation, one of the early kind of conservative think tanks of the 70s, and also to write a book called The Time for Truth, which is a kind of Jeremiah to business leaders, encouraging them to become more politically active. And he will tell his story of New York, the fiscal crisis there, sort of viewing it as the crisis of liberalism in microcosm. So Simon, even though Simon comes out of the world of municipal bond trading in New York, he had worked at Salomon Brothers, he is intensely opposed to aiding the city. And is, you know, kind of, he really makes the argument that if the city goes bankrupt, that will not be that big a problem, either for the city or for the rest of the country, that people in New York are just fomenting a lot of anxiety about it, and that the, you know, that it should be allowed to fail as kind of evidence of the bankruptcy of the kinds of policies the city's pursuing, and as a kind of, you know, just punishment for its sins. So the Ford administration kind of really puts bankruptcy on the agenda, but in a way, and does so, I think, pretty knowingly. I mean, there was a sense that a default, as one other, not Simon, but a junior guy in the Treasury Department said, you know, default would not be, you know, a bad thing. It would have a kind of cleansing effect. So it's, you know, they put it out there, and as a result, it becomes this kind of realistic option.
And you say, one, just bring back to City College, it seems like one of the things that even Ford himself, right, who's not one of these moving conservatives, one of the things he just seemed to, like, almost like viscerally oppose was this notion of, like, free college for people. He just couldn't wrap his head around
that. Right, free college was, like, he collects these memos and these briefing memos about how, what to say in the meeting with Beam and Carey, and yes, free college, or CUNY and tuition at CUNY. The symbolic importance of this is very clear to
He's
him.
So intent on the symbolic importance of things, right, in a way that just seems dickish in retrospect. But it's like, no, why can't you just raise subway fares by 15 cents?
Right.
And Beam says, that won't do anything for the problem. He's like, no, but it'll show that you're serious and committed to this.
Right, yeah. And I think there's a very strong sense of wanting to find things that the city can do that will demonstrate to investors that the city has really changed. And is not going to pursue the kinds of welfare state policies it previously had adopted.
And it does seem that, so when Ford arrives, there is more of a sense that, and so, as I mentioned earlier, the book's subtitle, New York's Fiscal Crisis and the Rise of Austerity Politics. So even if bankers earlier in the crisis didn't come in with a sense that we can use austerity to impose,
right,
we can use the crisis to impose these austerity measures,
yeah,
that in the White House at this period, there is much more of a conscious sense that this is an opportunity we're not going to let go to waste.
Yeah, I think...
Or that potentially could be used for this.
I think, again, I think, you know, in a way, the... In the White House, there is a strong sense that this is a moment to teach a political lesson.
Yeah, liberals brought this on themselves.
Liberals brought this on themselves, and they move very quickly. Liberals will bring this on the entire country, and that... What happens in New York is kind of, New York has to adopt a budget cutting and belt tightening mentality, and that is the same thing that the United States as a whole has to do. And what happens in New York, you know, what happens in New York should be so severe that no city will ever want to go down the same road again. And I think they view it as a chance to teach a political lesson to New Yorkers, to other city dwellers, and in the end, to the country as a whole. I think, you know, in a way, I think, yeah, it's not just a programmatic, I mean, it's not so much just kind of distilling into a program, but I think there is a very strong ideological response to it. And, you know, rather than, you know, viewing the crisis as the result of particular local problems or think it or saying, you know, how would things have played out differently had the Ford administration said, listen, there's no way we're going to allow the city to go bankrupt. We will take that as kind of a bottom line. Let's think about other ways you might refinance your debt. Or, you know, that would have really generated, I think, a different approach to the whole issue in the city. And that they didn't do it, I think, is connected to this sense of this is a political crisis, not just an economic one, and we will make sure that everybody in New York and across the country gets the right political lesson.
So, well, and one of the points that Beam will plead in response to the Ford administration, he says, I'm doing as much cutting as I can without sparking social crisis. And right. You see real, real resistance. He spent a lot of time on this wasn't the changes that are happening. They're not taking place without a fight.
Right. Well, I think that was the other element of this book, or one of the things that, you know, kind of growing up in New York, or the dominant narrative about the fiscal crisis, I think, is generally, you know, the city had no alternative. Everybody understood that, and people kind of accepted it and, you know, kind of lived with the cutbacks. And I think that that is actually, that is in really deep ways, that's not true, that the cutbacks actually generated a great deal of active resistance, as well as a kind of much more, you know, passive and quieter sense of discontent. But in the book, I do write about the way that New Yorkers, some of the different campaigns that different groups of New Yorkers waged against the loss of services to which they've been accustomed. So just to give a quick sense, the city winds up cutting its police force by around 20%. The fire department loses a little bit less than 20% of its employees. The Board of Education, a little bit less than 15%. The sanitation workers, around 19%. Parks and maintenance cut back very deeply. You know, all of these different basic city services are cut back heavily at this point.
And this is all facilitated by this sort of like technocratic budget management agency that takes responsibility for a lot of these decisions out of the hands of the city government, right?
Yeah. So the state creates two state agencies, one which is supposed to kind of refinance the city's debts by issuing these new bonds backed by a different sales tax stream, and then a second agency, the Emergency Financial Control Board, which kind of gets a final veto power over the city's budget.
And still has it today, right?
It does, although it's actually not active. I mean, the Financial Control Board still exists.
There are conditions where it could come into play. Right. And this is, you depict this as a specter that's always sort of lurking in the background, potentially.
Right. It could come, but it doesn't actually. For many years, it actually comes.
Yeah, so right now, it's just Chekhov's gunning out there, right, in the world. Yes. No, we're not in the third act yet.
Right. But if the city's budget kind of slips into deficit in different ways, then the Financial Control Board will come back. This board was staffed by the mayor and the comptroller are on it, but the other five members of the board, the governor is on it, and the state comptroller, I believe, and then three people who are from the private sector and who at that point were all drawn from private industry. And there were, you know, different, there was no labor member, there was no representative of, you know, communities. You know,
exactly. It's like, take that, working class New York.
Right. There's like one moment where, you know, kind of African-American and Latino state legislators ask for a seat on the board. That goes nowhere. So the final power over the city's budget, comes to rest in this Emergency Financial Control Board. Which doesn't, you know, in a way, as the crisis goes on, that becomes... The Emergency Financial Control Board is not, by and large, kind of trying to micromanage the city's budget. And it's actually interesting. There are debates within the board, like, should we be more active in kind of pushing a plan to reorganize the CUNY system or the Health and Hospitals Corporation? Many people on the board don't actually kind of say we shouldn't try to set policy directly, but we're just this kind of check. And in a way, the Beam administration kind of later starts to kind of uses the board to say, this is why we can't do this. So they actually, it's not a totally oppositional relationship.
Oh, no, they can be a really convenient excuse, right? It's a good cop, bad cop relationship.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, and this is, that brings up one of the points I love most about this book, where you point out that this is not sort of an outside imposition by reactionary conservatives. You know, it's like Bill Buckley's not dictating the decision they're made here. You say this is a story about like what a group that's dominated by liberals is deciding to do when confronted with these options during this period.
Yeah, one of the things, another thing that's really interesting to me working on the book is the New York's leadership is obviously really mostly from the Democratic Party at this point. And even, you know, many of the people, the bankers who become active in the city's affairs are also, you know, they're members of the Democratic Party, and they self-identify as liberals. And they really continue to do so as the crisis goes on. It's just that what the content of that is shifting, so that they now come to feel and to believe that the first responsibility of the public sector is to encourage economic development and to aid the private sector, because otherwise there won't be any resources for the public sector to do anything. And I think they're making this shift and kind of trying to modulate their stance towards business, to change the relationship with both popular movements and the labor movement. They're doing this kind of in interesting tandem with developments that are taking place within the National Democratic Party over the 1970s.
So is this a case study in the rise of neoliberalism?
In a certain way, I think it is. I think it is a study in neoliberalism is a complex concept or sticky concept in different ways, but I think it is... It is definitely a story which is about the shifts within, kind of how liberals think of themselves and what liberals value. And so in a way it is, it's not, and I think also a story about the shift in the kind of common wisdom and common popular perception. There's a line that I really like in Mason's book, City of Ambition, which I was talking about earlier, about New York in the 30s and early 40s. And this the kind of sense in the political culture that people look to the state as, or look to the city government to provide solutions for problems. And this is partly, about how that changes and gives way, that kind of common wisdom and common faith. So I think it's a book about liberals and about a shift in the common wisdom about politics.
Which is really from a sense that the government's obligation is to look out for social welfare to the business climate. And one of the first and most significant beneficiaries of this transition, you point out, is Donald Trump, who has a not insignificant cameo here.
Yes. So Trump appears in the book, which again, I was as surprised as anybody when Trump actually won the election. So, but he was Trump was a young, in his late 20s, in the mid 70s. He was the son, of a prominent outer borough landlord and developer. Who owned tens of thousands of outer borough apartments, but wasn't an active player in Manhattan real estate, which Trump wanted to be. And his first major deal is developing the Commodore Hotel, which is near Grand Central Terminal. The Commodore was a kind of, beautiful old early 20th century hotel, which had fallen on hard times by the early 70s and was going to be shut down. And Trump, working with the Hyatt Regency Corporation, proposes to buy the property, then lease it to a state, or sell it to a state agency and lease it back, and through this arrangement, wind up with a significant reduction in property taxes, a reduction that, according to a New York Times story from late last year, has been worth more than $350 million to Trump and to Hyatt to this point. They're still not paying the complete property taxes on the hotel there, the Grand Hyatt. And I think, yes, again, one of the, this story, at the time there was a kind of an anxiety about it in the city. And, the question, how could New York, which was almost bankrupt, forego all this money in property taxes? Did it make sense to give it away? And I think, some of the people who have written about Trump, there's a kind of expose-like quality. This is he's a canny developer taking advantage of a desperate city. Obviously, there's a certain truth to that. But at the same time, the city administration really trumpeted the Trump deal. They really celebrated it. And the economic development administrator for the city said, this is like the first deal in our new program. it is meant, and here again there's that kind of sense of symbolism, it is meant to send a signal to the entire business community that there has been a change, and a, you know, to suggest that the city government is going to try to shed the image that it's really directed towards social welfare goals, and instead that it now recognizes and values the importance of corporate leadership and development in the city. And the kinds of property tax deals that help the Commodore redevelopment happen do expand in the late 70s and afterward.
And so Trump, it sort of brings us back not just to sort of key themes in this book as a whole, but to key themes in your first book, which I mentioned earlier, Invisible Hands, which is a sort of essential book for understanding the making of the modern conservative movement. And you mentioned earlier that having done this new book, you have some different perspectives on the story that you were telling in that first book. Could you elaborate on those?
Well, I think that it is, this book, you know, it is, formally or as a book, as a piece of writing, it's structured. This is a story which really takes place over a few years, whereas Invisible Hands, kind of went from their 30s to 1980. And I think part of the reason for that is one of the critiques that people had of Invisible Hands was a sense that it's telling too linear a story in a way, or that didn't do enough to take into account the problems, especially of the 1970s, and the problems of the end of economic growth and how that kind of reshapes the whole terrain for American politics. And so I think in a way this book is sort of reflecting on that, or on that, periodization, and trying to look more at the shift, not just the ascendance of the conservative movement, but a shift in the whole political terrain that takes place at this time. So I think that's one difference between the two books. I think it's much, although I don't, Invisible Hands, some people, this was not really my intention with it, but I think some people have interpreted it as a much more kind of partisan history, a history that's about the rise of a certain strand of the Republican Party. And, although that wasn't, I think, exactly my intention in the book, I do understand why people think that. After all, it ends in 1980 with the election of Reagan. And in this book too, I think I viewed that as a real problem. Because I don't actually think you can really understand the rightward shift of American politics just by looking at the emergence of a kind of hard right in the Republican Party. I think it is a larger transformation than that, and one that the transformation of the Democratic Party is critical to thinking about as well. And so, in a way, this book is offering another way to think about some of those questions. And Trump's rise is very, Trump's ascendance within New York real estate circles, and I think actually you could probably trace this out more broadly as well, it really depended on the active participation and complicity of people in the Democratic Party establishment here. It wouldn't have happened without them. And I think that's, you can't just look at him as this bizarre aberration that reflects only a kind of twisted part of the far right, although, I think that's important too. You can definitely understand that in him as well, but that's also not the whole story. And I think what's the larger question is kind of what is the relationship of that to a much more widely shared politics.
You've been fantastically generous with your time, and I know we have to let you go soon, but before I do, I just can't resist. We talked about how writing this book has sort of encouraged you to revisit some questions from your first one. As you know, Rick Perlstein had a recent story in the New York Times Magazine saying that the election of Donald Trump is like prompting a sort of similar reconsideration of the history of conservatism as a whole, in a sense that the story that the last generation of historians has been telling ever since Alan Brinkley wrote this seminal article on the subject of, his argument was that American historians had neglected the subject of American conservatism for a host of reasons. And since then, there was this, wave of some of the best, in my opinion, some of the best work in Polk history over the last generation, which to a significant degree, took conservatives, like, very seriously, almost mm-hmm. on their own terms.
Right.
And Perlstein's argument was that it had gone too far in that direction, and that the account of the rise of conservatism was too much of a story that reflected how sort of the world as seen from the offices of National Review, and that as a consequence, it had overstated the significance of a conservative movement dedicated to this synthesis of adherence to the free market, the importance of evangelical movement, opposition to communism, and it neglected more sort of cruder, straightforward interpretations that focused on white nationalism, mm-hmm. and that instead of drawing a line from, say, Barry Goldwater to Ronald Reagan to the present, you could just as easily draw one from Joe McCarthy to George Wallace to the present, with sort of like mm-hmm. in deep roots going on before that. What do you make of that yeah. argument?
Well, I think I really liked Rick's piece a lot, and I think it's interesting. I think that there is, I guess I have two responses. I mean, one response is that yes, I think it's right that that historians of conservatism should and need to do more to grapple with and place the conservative mobilization and Trump himself kind of in this much broader pantheon of conservative and right-wing politics. And people should, you know, be aware of the resonances between, or should write about American fascists. They should write about American Nazis. They should write about and think about the second Ku Klux Klan. Linda Gordon has a book coming out about it, which I think will be terrific. And the second
KKK, just to be clear, that's the movement that rises in the 1920s, not the sort of 1870s one.
Right. The second KKK, the movement.
And that's just as much like anti-Catholic as it is anti-black.
Yeah. And which Fred Trump, Donald Trump's father, is supposed to have been kind of a sort of in the orbit of somewhat. And, you know, I mean, even looking, you know, later on down the road, looking at the third Ku Klux Klan, or the one that emerges in the 60s to fight the civil rights movement, and kind of what happens to it afterward, and looking at, you know, the kind of the sort of violent libertarians of the far west, and so I think kind of all these people who are sort of written out of the respectable right.
Yeah, the kooks that people like Buckley are supposed to have exiled from the movement in the 1960s.
I think kind of looking at that political tradition and being kind of taking it, you know, I think it's complicated for historians because you kind of want to treat your subjects sympathetically and take them seriously, but also these are people who have very bizarre ideas about the world.
But you can take them seriously without taking them sympathetically.
Without taking them sympathetically, yes, exactly. Kind of recognizing that they're not just, you know, out there freaks, but that they, you know, their politics actually speak to a, you know, not insignificant part of the American public. And even if they aren't, you know, doing so as like full members of those movements, they resonate with things that people believe more deeply about their world. And so I do actually think like that was kind of what I took from that article of Rick's. And I think that is actually a really important project. At the same time, I think that the answer is not, is sort of not to go deeper into kind of viewing that whole mobilization as separate, but the problem for historians has to be to think about its relationship to the so-called respectable right, the points of connection and resonance that make these not just fringe ideas, but that reverberate out into the broader culture. And to continue, I mean, another part of Rick's argument in that piece, which I think got a little bit less attention, but is, you know, continuing to think about the relationship between elites and kind of what happens to the relationship between elites and the broader conservative mobilization and the kind of deeply undemocratic and hierarchical ideas.
I feel like it could almost be a story of how elites tricked themselves into thinking that the movement was different than it was.
Yes,
that someone like the Koch brothers could believe that, no, there really is this like populist base for the libertarian agenda. When in fact there's like, no, or at least by 2016, it was clear that it eroded completely. It's certainly someone like Ted Cruz, that was his theory of the case of the nomination, was like, I'm going to be the movement conservative candidate and there's nothing that could stop me.
Right, and that you know, it just they're never what the populist base that they imagine just doesn't really exist. I mean, I guess the last thing, and this maybe goes against completely the question of sort of looking at the far right. I do also think that it is a kind of this serious problem to think about, like try to holding these things together in one's mind at the same time. to look not just at the far right, but as its relationship to the changes in liberalism that kind of enable and maybe drive the rise of this further, you know, this extreme conservatism, and to kind of to always be thinking about both at the same moment. And so not, again, like not to separate it out, but to see it or try to see it as part of a broader whole. And I think that's, again, like that's kind of just to bring it back to Fear City, that's part of what this book is, you know, is trying to do, or what parts of it's the way that I write about Trump is kind of trying to treat his emergence that way. And more generally, to kind of try to treat the book ends, or one of the last parts of the book is about the blackout of 1977, which, you know, many people have written about as the wave of property destruction that follows the blackout. And you know, I was both interested in kind of how widespread that was, and how it's not just kind of a group of kind of young people of color breaking into things, but how truly widespread it really appears to have been. But also just the kind of the reaction against it, and the kind of viciousness of that reaction, and the calls to bring back police brutality and to, you know, shoot people on sight, and this and I think it, you know, that is coming out of the context of the fiscal crisis in a way, and of the collapse of social resources, and of the experience of austerity, and the withdrawal of support for the kinds of institutions that build a kind of broader common public life. It's at a moment, in a way, when the city actually has been robbed, although, you know, not by a very different group of people. And anyway, this is all kind of a long-winded way of saying that I think we need to look at those kinds of reactions and the kind of violent far right as part of a story that's about austerity, and I guess you could call it neoliberalism, and kind of a broader set of attacks on public institutions. And, you know, in a way, that's, I think, also the answer to meet it with politically. So that's kind of a very long answer, but I think that in a way, I think somehow thinking about the right, the challenge for historians now is both to think about the far right and also to think about the bigger picture and liberalism and its relationship to this movement.
That's an excellent way to end a fantastic conversation about a fantastic book. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a delight.